This episode of the Gospel Coalition podcast is sponsored by The Gospel Project, a chronological, Christ-centered Bible study that shows kids, students, and adults how all Scripture testifies to Jesus Christ. Learn more at gospelproject.com.
This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen.
This is Colin Hansen, and we're going to do things a little bit differently this week on the Gospel Coalition podcast. Thanks for joining us. Today, I'm going to be interviewed, and our interviewer is going to be Justin Taylor. He's Executive Vice President of Book Publishing and Book Publisher for Crossway, also blogger at Between Two Worlds for the Gospel Coalition. So, Justin, go ahead and take it away.
All right, Colin, thanks. It's a privilege to be able to sit in the podcast hosting chair today and turn the microphone on you. Well, first there was Augustine hearing a voice in the garden telling him to take up and read. Then there was Luther nailing the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg door. Then in the 20th century, Billy Graham's Madison Square Garden evangelistic crusade. And then 21st century was your article for Christianity Today. Did I get the chronology right?
Yeah, I think that it might be the most ludicrous thing I have ever heard, and I must immediately disavow it. But I think, yeah, the chronology is basically correct, yeah.
Okay, I just didn't know if I had the right order there. So September 22nd, 2006, you wrote a cover story for Christianity Today called Young, Restless, and Reformed. Maybe initial question, did you come up with the title?
I am going to give credit to that title to Mark Galley, the editor of Christianity Today. It was something that was rolling around in my head, and it was one of the things that I felt like captured the different dimensions to what we were getting at here, the differences with from theology and how it was changing. But ultimately, that would be the managing editor's call of what to go with there. So I'll give Mark Galley credit for that one.
That's great. And good job, Mark Galley. It is interesting how in subsequent discussions, the nomenclature there has actually been a means of analysis for the movement itself, its youth, but then also its restlessness.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really what I was trying to get at with the article, that this was certainly Reformed theology, but it was a different kind of Reformed theology in some ways, in that a lot of the movement was Baptistic and not Presbyterian, though certainly there were a lot of Presbyterian influences, that it was especially popular among the young, much more so than with older groups. And it was restless in that people were responding. They were upset about some other trends among their own generation, but among previous generations, among older generations. And there was also a sense of potential immaturity here. I remember looking at the Acts 29 church planting network at the time and thinking, this is either like the most spectacular thing I have ever seen, or it's going to implode. And that's kind of how I felt about the whole thing, is there was this uneasy tension of, this is really exciting, but this is also really volatile. And I don't really know how it's going to turn out. And we continue to live in that story, not really sure exactly how it's going to turn out. But we certainly do have a little bit more perspective now after 10 years.
So take us back 10 years ago. Because it's often easy to forget what things were like back then. So 2006, when you pitched this story to your editors, did it immediately resonate with them? Did you have to talk them into it? Or did they say, oh yeah, you're identifying something that we've been seeing and we've been wanting somebody to write about?
Yeah, that's a great question. I did not have a problem with the editors at Christianity Today. I had a problem with the people I was trying to interview for the story. So Mark, again, was very interested in the article idea from early on. Mark's responses were essentially, you know, Reformed theology has always been very important to Christianity Today. If you go back to somebody like Carl Henry being the first editor of Christianity Today, even though you wouldn't describe Billy Graham as the founder of Christianity Today as being Reformed, still there's always been that strain at Christianity Today and then just in evangelicalism at large. And I remember him saying that as long as, maybe even between 5 and 10 years before I got there, there was already a movement of people who were really fascinated by John Piper's writing, his ministry, this might have been a little bit in the aftermath of the Passion Movement. So there are 6 years between Passion One Day 2000, the Don't Waste Your Life message from John Piper, and when I wrote this article. So he was becoming much more popular. But you already had books like Desiring God and stuff like that out there, and people who are really drawn to the ideas of Christian hedonism. So there was definitely a sense among the editors at Christian Today that this was a legitimate phenomenon and that they wanted to write about it. I'll never forget, I just love the backstory stuff here, but I'll never forget Harold Myra, one of my mentors, former CEO, longtime CEO of Christian Today. And I remember him coming down to my office because I was the copy editor at the time. And he dropped off the copy, I mean, kind of marked up. He would look at everything that went in the issue and bring it down to me and circulate it back through my desk. And I remember him saying, gosh, this is really good, Kyle. This is great. Next month, let's take a look at the Arminians. And I just thought it was a good explanation for what we were trying to do at Christianity. You're trying to keep this big evangelical tent pretty happy, you know, and keep it plenty wide. And there was a sense in which, okay, we've got to keep this a little bit balanced here. And certainly there are a lot of dynamic movements on the non-reform side of things within evangelicalism, though none of them with quite the same theological, solidarity and expressive of a particular movement as the Young Restless Reformed. So I didn't really have any problems. People were, they understood the phenomenon within Christianity Today. Not everybody would have thought it was a great thing or something worth applauding, but they certainly would have acknowledged it as worthy of news coverage. The more difficult time I had was interviewing some people like John Piper, who I think had grown somewhat wary of Christianity Today over the years, and some of its theological positions or some of its lack of theological positions. And so sometimes I didn't always get the warmest reception, or just some people were confused. Like, is this a trick? Yeah, I mean, is there something else at play here? And so in those cases, I would just have to go out of my way to really explain where I was coming from on it. And one of the difficulties of this project all along has been the asset for me as a journalist is that I'm in the middle of this. That could be a problem as well, but I think it was helpful for me in the article to be able to get perspective from the people on the inside, that they felt like I would be able to tell their story in a way that they would understand and respect.
So as a journalist, as a student of evangelical history, how do you know when something goes from, hey, a bunch of my friends and people online are listening to the same thing and talking about the same things, to this may be an identifiable movement?
Yeah, I remember looking at my wife. I remember exactly where we were. I remember looking at her saying, but what if it's all just a figment of my imagination? What if it's some kind of projection? What if it's not real? And so I think there's no way of knowing for sure. I would say from the historian's perspective, looking back, you could see that I was right. You could see that I had identified something. But oddly, this is what I never expected, Justin. Oddly, the article itself and book were catalysts of the movement. Like, the movement had not even understood itself as a movement in some ways. Now, you did have something like T4G, which I reported on in the article. So you did have this merging of charismatic with Southern Baptist with Presbyterian influences coming around the gospel. And that's certainly, T4G has been a formative influence in this. So there was some of that self-understanding. But I've really been amazed over time that different, you know, from a journalist perspective at the time, I'm trying to describe something and put some pieces together and to try to show it as a cohesive whole. But I think if you were writing on this as a historian, you would probably actually have to include the article in retrospect, because it did seem to have something of a unifying, identifying effect, as people said, oh, I didn't even realize I was part of something, but now I am. So that's just a fascinating dynamic that I did not anticipate at the time.
It is. That was going to be one of my questions, is whether or not your article helped to create the movement, solidify it, identify it. And I think you're right that as historians might look back upon this, what began as reporting about a movement did in some form give shape to the movement and even a label or identity. I think one of the lines that stands out most to me, or stood out most to me when I first read it, was the following. While the emergent quote-unquote conversation gets a lot of press for its appeal to the young, the new reform movement may be a larger and more pervasive phenomenon. Very few people calling themselves emergent today. I don't think there's any emergent network anymore, but was... on the converse, the emergent movement itself somewhat a creation of the press and getting a lot of notoriety through and its numbers perhaps being inflated by the attention that it was given by writers on religion.
Yeah. It's fascinating to see, because there was a restless element to both of those movements, right? So there was some volatility, and in fact, there were some figures who crossed those boundaries. So you had somebody like Mark Driscoll, who'd had a foot in both worlds. It is amazing to me, as I look back on those two, those kind of the mid 2000s, is the number of people who were kind of the ethos, the anti-institutional, or the things have to change, or the informality, or the missional focus of the emergent thing was very appealing to them. But then when they started to dig deeper into some of the epistemological issues, some of the theological revisionism and things like that, it was not very appealing to them. But precisely because there was this reformed movement that was coming up alongside. And that movement, I think it actually captured a good bit of some of the missional impulse, a little bit of the anti-institutionalism, which is expressed in some ways through denominational frustration, I think, and through church planting and stuff like that. But certainly without the doctrinal revisionism. But there, I think it's because the reform movement certainly had much deeper roots. And because, I think this is also significant, those young people that I was writing about and that I was myself a part of, we had a lot of role models in their 40s, 50s, and 60s at the time. There were some of those figures, but really the leading voices were in their 30s and 40s with the emergent church. And so there was a big difference there in terms of the rootedness of the older generation. The restlessness kind of petered out a little bit, at least, of the Reformed movement, because they had heroes like J.I. Packer. They had heroes like R.C. Sproul. They had heroes like John Piper, Don Carson, and people like that who were really rooted and were not themselves restless anymore. And that's probably the most significant factor. Also, really the focus on the church and the embrace of their denominational responsibilities. That's and their institutional responsibilities. We could get into this. This is a much bigger trend here, but that's probably why I would say at least the Reformed movement moved in one direction and has been and has proven to be much more larger, stable, and more pervasive, as I said back in 2006, but also why the emerging church simply did not really just collapsed, in part because there was no cohesive theological unity. The unity was in the response to other things. The unity was in being upset about other stuff, but there was no positive program. And then you have an issue that I did not write about at the time, but that other people were observing around this same time. You had the issue of homosexuality come up and really start to press the evangelical church. That's really kind of, you if you move in one direction, you kind of you're either within the historic continuity of the Orthodox Church, or you're part of a truly new thing, and that has really separated those two movements over the course of the last 16 years, at the very least.
That's all very helpful, Colin. You mentioned Mark Driscoll a little bit ago. I want to ask you two questions about Mark. So the first one has kind of a narrow focus, and then I'll ask a follow-up question. But the first one is, how important was Mark Driscoll to the early success and popularity and notoriety of YRR? You know, there was a long, slow build. You mentioned Packer and Sproul and Lloyd Jones, and of course Piper was on the scene for many years, and you know, his most popular early book was in 1986. But was Mark Driscoll an essential element to getting YRR on the radar screen of the wider American public?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mark is the embodiment of what I'm talking about, of those two trends. The issue, though, is that Mark was also the embodiment of another trend, of the charismatic movement. And those always, I did a profile of Mark sometime later in Christianity Today, and described the merging of this Reformed soteriology with an emergent sort of aesthetic and a missional impulse, along with a charismatic orientation. It was a volatile mix, and it simply was not going to last. But you could see why so many different people were drawn to him, sometimes for very different reasons. But in all of the travels that I've had, and all the talking with people for this project and in subsequent years, many, many, many people have cited Mark Driscoll specifically, his sermons. Keep in mind, in that early to mid-2000s period, he's publishing a lot. He's publishing a lot of books. And he's reaching a different kind of group. You know, the number of people who were reading Jonathan Edwards was probably never a really huge group. The number of people reading John Piper was a much bigger group, especially the influence of the Passion movements on his on spreading his ministry. But John Piper is not the easiest person in the world to read. Not a lot of people were familiar, certainly at the time, with Tim Keller, and his books are pretty popular now. But still, he's not going to reach the most popular level of people. But Mark always did. And so you'd have people from so many varied backgrounds, so many people who had fallen away from the church, so many people who had tenuous connections to the church, so many people who were really inspired by the message that he was preaching. And just keep in mind, the church planting dimension to this is so significant. I don't think I gave that nearly enough attention, because probably it just hadn't crystallized yet at the time, between 2006 and 2008. But the church planting component of this is just absolutely enormous. And I've always thought of Mark Driscoll on one coast and Tim Keller on the other coast as the two twin inspirations for that. Keller's with, I think, a more global, urban, apologetic, sophisticated approach. And Mark's more of a traditional evangelical, pioneering Baptistic approach to just go out there and just win some souls. You know, I was doing an analysis recently of the Second Great Awakening and church planting, and the anti-institutionalism, the anti-authority, the anti-creedalism, and all this sort of stuff that was really a lot of the dynamic essentials of the Second Great Awakenings, particularly among Baptists and Methodists. And I said to this group of church planters, who does this sound like in our day? And really, it was Mark Driscoll is who it sounded like. And I would say so many of those kind of the restlessness that was essential to this movement was really embodied in Mark's ministry. I don't know exactly where you're going with your second question, but we can discuss, you know, how that subsequently played out. But at least at its origins, it would be impossible to tell this story without talking about Mark.
I think that's a really important point, Colin, and I'm glad you went into that depth on it, because I think it would be very easy to sort of rewrite history and say, oh no, Mark was always he was all flash, but he wasn't really that essential to it. It was more of a Piper, Endeavor, and TGC, and T4G things. So I appreciate acknowledging how important he was and how much he ministered to people. So the follow-up is that for many critics of YRR, TGC, T4G, all of the various acronyms that we use, Mark, along with what happened with the Elephant Room, kind of becomes exhibit A for we told you so. We were saying these things from the beginning. We were predicting that this was not going to end well. We were lamenting that you were investing spiritual authority and capital into a guy who did things that seemed unseemly or unwise. Was it I told you so moment for the critics? Are the critics right that that was a weakness, maybe even an inherent weakness in the institutions and celebrity dynamics that are part of YRR?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't think there's any sense in me running away from that. I think there is an I told you so moment. And I mean, I remember all the criticism and all the warnings that came from John MacArthur in particular. And certainly there's a lot of wisdom in what he was saying. He perceived a lot of significant problems. And I would imagine that some of why MacArthur was particularly dialed in on some of those things is because of his interaction with charismatics, and probably some of the dynamics that he had seen in the charismatic Pentecostal movement on the West Coast. Also, you know, keep in mind there in the aftermath, he's in the same context as the Jesus movement and the Jesus people, those revivals that produced a lot of the charismatic Pentecostal movement. So I think he probably perceived that, as you saw subsequent more reformed-oriented charismatic movements come up, that he had seen some of the inherent instability of previous charismatic movements, and some of the turn from this democratic populism into authoritarianism. I don't know exactly how to explain how that happens in some charismatic Pentecostal movements, but it's a historical reality in many cases. And so I think there is something to be said of the I told you so about somebody like Mark. The only thing I'd add there, though, Justin, is that when it came time to write the book in 2008, based off the 2006 article, I would have probably told you that a brash, young pastor in Dallas, Texas, trying to make sure if I get my timeline even here of when I first heard about Matt Chandler, but I probably would have said that he would be less likely to last over the long haul. I would have probably indicated more concern, especially because Mark was so well connected to a lot of mentor type figures, at least within groups like the Gospel Coalition, that I thought that would be a positive influence on him. He was also really rooted in some elements of church history as somebody who read pretty widely in theology and history. I don't know that I picked up on all of that with Matt Chandler from the same time. And so the only thing that I would say, just in terms of the I told you so, is that as we've seen some other young preachers come up, like Matt Chandler, we've seen some other preachers come up, like David Platt, you would have had a lot of reasons to offer the same critiques of them. They were young, they were brash, they didn't have everything all put together, they said some things that they would regret, they were very critical of other evangelical expressions, older generations, churches, things like that. But they didn't turn out the same way, Lord willing. Their stories have taken a very different trajectory. I do think there's a particular reason for that. I'll just go ahead and say, I think the reason is that both of those men that I mentioned there, Matt and David, have experienced significant suffering. Matt through his brain cancer, of course, and David through losing all his possessions. In New Orleans with Katrina while he was in seminary. So I think there were some differences there, but that was the whole deal, that we didn't know how that would work out. And I think, Justin, if you took any cross-section of 30-something-year-old pastors or church leaders now or then, 2006 or 2016, it'd probably be the same deal. It's one reason why I saw somebody recently say that he loves that his heroes are dead because they've already made all their mistakes. Those of us in our 30s or 40s, we have a lot more mistakes to make, unfortunately.
So I don't have a sophisticated timeline here, but perhaps we could think about why RR 1.0 is focused on soteriology, okay? Like, think about Packer writing back in the day about limited atonement and R.C. Sproul on the 5 points of Calvinism. And I think John Piper was as controversial for his claims about God's absolute sovereignty as he was for any claims about Christian hedonism. So maybe that's phase one. And then maybe why RR 2.0 focused on ecclesiology, as people saw that perhaps part of the problem with the implosion of Mark Driscoll's ministry is that he didn't have a very good ecclesiology or polity. So somebody like Mark Dever is left standing because he's thought through all of these things very carefully, even if you don't agree with how he dots every I or crosses every T. So if that's kind of phase one and phase two, I'm wondering if phase three, the conversations are going to primarily focus around race and gender. I know it's an impossibly large question, but could you talk a little bit about how both of those things, race and gender, are intersecting with YRR, how people in this movement are thinking about those two explosive and important topics?
Yeah, that's not a controversial question at all, so I appreciate the softball. You know, I was actually going to say, I didn't know where you were going with that question. I would have articulated just a little bit different, and I would have just said public theology. So certainly gender and race would come up under the broader category of public theology because they are the issues that are the most volatile in our culture today. I would have said our attitude toward the broader culture. And that's going to certainly involve the soteriology, which affects sort of the Lord's sovereign work in the world. That's going to affect it's going to be related to your ecclesiology, how the church is sort of a bulwark against these influences from the world, but also a vanguard of the mission into the world. But then more broadly with public theology, I would think about what is it like to be on the margins, to thrive on the margins? What is it like to be able to suffer and endure as outcasts? What is it going to be like for us to be able to trust God and to fulfill our responsibility for the Great Commission when we are under institutional contraction, where perhaps we may be losing a lot of the institutions that we've invested in over a long period of time, perhaps even our Christian colleges as the noose of sexuality really and discrimination tightens on us. So I think, I mean, that more broadly is what I would identify as the issue. But you're exactly right. Race and gender are the two significant factors of where that comes in. I'll say with gender, that actually the fights that the YRR movement fought over complementarianism have really saved us from a lot of grief later. So it might have been a difficult thing to deal with up front because it was anything but sure that this movement would be exclusively or nearly exclusively complementarian. That was not a settled discussion. Probably, I'd say, Justin, that's owing to the significant Baptist influence and especially the Southern Baptist influence. And I mean that both in the term.
You're talking about kind of behind the scenes, offline conversations, not public debates.
Well, even both. I mean, because I guess what I'm saying is, yes, for an institution like the Gospel Coalition, that we would put into our confessional statement a plank on complementarian gender roles in the church and in the home, no, that was not assured. That was something that was actually discussed and debated among people that could have gone either way. But I think even then, the fact that it was a discussion indicated that it already was kind of going hand in hand. And I think that's because of the particular influence of certain significant Baptist and many of them Southern Baptist figures in this. I don't mean to exclude the PCA for any particular reason there. It's just when I think about some of the keynote leaders like a John Piper, longstanding influence on this issue through CBMW and others, and then also Wayne Grudem's influence through his systematic theology, and then also Al Mohler and his influence at Southern Seminary. You know, that's another place where if you look back on Greg Will's history of Southern Seminary, he shows very clearly that when Mohler came on board, there were many people who wanted him in 1993 to make the school a more broadly evangelical school like Trinity or Gordon Conwell, which have basic egalitarian views, but Trinity has a technically complementarian view, but functionally in many ways are egalitarian. In other words, they don't make it an issue, which leans them a little bit more toward the egalitarian side of things. Gordon Conwell actually is officially egalitarian, but you can see the differences. It's not a line of demarcation among evangelicals, I'll put it that way. But among Southern Baptists, it has been one of their identifying marks, going back to the conservative resurgence, going back to the Baptist Faith and Message that came out in 2000, things like that. And so that's what I mean, is that now gender, transgender issues, homosexuality, those are just such difficult, divisive issues that are really tearing through the evangelical movement. But because the YRR movement has already fought through some of those things to take a more conservative stance, that's held the line in such a way that we're not dealing with these other issues down the line. So that's what I mean about gender. Is that clear up what you're looking for on that one?
Yeah, I just think it seems like the discussion is moving. It's not something that has been left in the past. And in the way that I almost never see fights break out on Twitter on the 5 points of Calvinism today. Maybe it's just don't follow the right people. But that's just, it's either people are kind of locked in on where they're at on that issue, but a lot of discussion on complementarianism and a lot of discussion on racial issues.
Well, I would say, Justin, even the complementarian issue has shifted because I don't see as much debate about that anymore. I see a whole lot of debate from the people who used to be egalitarian, who I guess are still egalitarian, but are now also LGBTQ affirming. We're now gay affirming. Mm. So I think that discussion has shifted as well, but it's shifted on the other side of things.
So as you look forward to the next 10 years, maybe we'll end with this question. We've touched on this a little bit already, but we're 10 years in, if indeed your article and book helped to create or solidify or identify the movement. What do you think the biggest challenges and opportunities are in the next decade ahead?
Well, I'll come back to that race question, Justin. It's one that I've been thinking about a lot lately, and I think that's a point of very serious tension. It's been brought to the forefront through things like Ferguson and subsequent events. It falls under that broad public theology issue there. People are going to disagree about certain specifics in terms of what it looks like to have effective policing and what anti-poverty programs look like. I mean, there's going to be a lot of disagreement. I wouldn't expect unity among Reformed Christians on all of those questions. But at some level, as this country continues to become more secular among the whites in particular, and where it becomes much more diverse ethnically across Asian, Latino, Black ethnicities, then this is an issue that's got to be at the forefront of attention for the YRR movement. There's going to have to a lot of listening, and I think it's going to go hand in hand, Justin. I mean, it's going to have to push beyond the basic diversity. So when I wrote about the Gospel Coalition back in 2008 or 2007, I think actually, for Christianity Today, I observed the significant ethnic diversity. And one of the things that Don Carson, our president, talked about was how that needed to be different from earlier evangelical movements. But in our day and age, for a lot of different reasons, diversity is not enough. There has to be a significant understanding of suffering and of the ongoing challenges faced by ethnic minorities, and some things that we as white Christians, and actually even in some ways, especially as white Reformed Christians, have been particularly blind to. So I see that as a place of, as an actual opportunity. I mean, it's amazing, Justin. The difference now is that now when I go out and talk to groups that are the college students today, they're incredibly diverse in terms of ethnicity, but then also just what backgrounds they're coming from. It's just fascinating and really encouraging. But that's going to continue to bring those issues to the forefront. I would also say, Justin, the other big opportunity but challenge is that we are in the middle of a significant transition. And if I were writing, an article or book today on this specific topic, I would point to the near election of J.D. Greer to the Southern Baptist Convention presidency as one of those inflection points, where the largest denomination in this country, the Southern Baptist Convention, went through one of those generational moments where they were coming to terms with who they'd been. Steve Gaines, the winner, coming from one of the most historic Southern Baptist churches where Adrian Rogers had previously pastored, Bellevue Baptist in Memphis, and J.D. Greer representing, whether or not he lines up everywhere theologically with Calvinists, nevertheless representing some of that missional, more reformed, evangelistic, globally engaged, urban engaged in college campuses and stuff like that approach, which is not always how you've thought of Southern Baptists historically. And I would say that's one of the huge just turning points, is that we're starting to see now that all of these leaders like Russell Moore, like David Platt, like J.D. Greer, stepping into official denominational leadership, especially in the SBC. You already have Al Mohler, you already have Danny Akin, you already have Jason Allen, I mean, at the different seminaries. So what I wrote about 10 years ago, Justin, was a benevolent insurgency. This was a movement to change things, but it wasn't an angry one. It wasn't one that was wanting to revise everything. In fact, much like the reformers earlier, they were trying to recover things, especially if you understand that within the Southern Baptist context and places like the Founders Ministries and things like that. Trying to restore some of the earlier theological emphases, but pair it with a real missional impulse for the 21st century. We're going to continue to see that this benevolent insurgency is now the institution. Those of us who were railing against the man 10 years ago, now we are the man. And what are we going to do with that? How are we going to steward what's been entrusted to us? How are we going to engage with other evangelicals? How are we going to lead? I don't know that there was necessarily a thought 10 years ago to lead, but I do think in many churches, in many institutions, publishing houses, and Christian colleges, and denominational offices, that group is now in charge, and that's an opportunity to steward well, to learn from and to steward well what's been entrusted us by previous generations, even when we took some pretty serious issue with them. So that's when we're going to find out if the young can age well, if the restless can retain their gospel motivations toward restlessness about fulfilling the Great Commission, but not the angst that you often associate with youth, and whether the Reformed will really press into their full Reformed heritage. For my Presbyterian listeners, I understand what you mean how you take that of what I say, and I know you'd be happy with that, but just to at least embrace the tradition that comes with that and continue to learn as it helps us to understand Scripture. So I'm excited, Justin. I think if anything, there's more opportunity for growth, and if the YRR movement can learn from some of the mistakes, can be humble, can continue to be, to learn from history, to be challenged by history, to learn from, again, even the history of the last 10 years of major mistakes that have been made by individuals and institutions that hopefully we can mature in a positive way. And I have to say that as I continue to look ahead at me of generations of men and women, they continue to inspire me, and I see them continuing to want to lead and to hand off some of the power in a very, very upstanding ways. And so I think if the older generation can continue to mentor us, to bear with us through a lot of our struggles, I think we're going to be okay. I'm pretty hopeful about God's work.
Well, Colin, your sober-minded optimism and example are always an encouragement to me. So many thanks for indulging my various questions here, and thanks for your faithfulness.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Justin. And I'm just glad to let you take the reins of the Gospel Coalition podcast this week.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.